He loud enough and he goes. It's the opposite.
Yeah.
Of the I'll call the House Committee on Health Care to order and open up an informational hearing on anything interesting we have. How about Cover Oregon? Let's try that one.
I was toying with the idea of putting bottles of barbecue sauce up there, but I thought it might send the wrong message. You know?
Dr. Goldberg, I can't tell you how welcome you are. We wait with anticipation.
Thank you, Chair Greenlick. Chair Greenlick, members of the committee, for the record, Bruce Goldberg, I am the interim director of executive director of Cover Oregon. I think as you know, and if you don't know, Rocky King, who was the executive director, has resigned. I am on leave from the Oregon Health Authority, and I am currently the interim executive director of Cover Oregon. With me today are Aaron Cardula and Amy Faber. And what I thought try and do is walk through sort of three areas with you, and then open it up for questions. Those are one, the status of the website and technology. You have actually a presentation that we gave earlier to the legislative IT Oversight Committee, and I'll refer to that briefly. Walk through where we are with enrollment, and walk through some of the issues about the future of Cover Oregon and the exchange, if that's okay, and then open it up for questions.
Great, thank you very much.
The finances, et cetera. So let me start by giving you an update as to where we are with technology. It's no surprise to anybody on the committee that we don't have a fully functioning website at this point, as what we had wanted, that can enroll people from end to end. We appreciate that every Cover Oregon customer who has gone through the system, that it's been difficult to date. We are using pieces of the technology to enroll people, but we are unable at this point to use the technology end to end. Individuals can apply online. We then have to manually enroll them into the IT system. The system then can process eligibility and determine eligibility, and then we get that information back to individuals, and then they can shop for and enroll in health plans online. They cannot, however, do that end to end. It's a hybrid process. It's not where we want it to be. It's difficult for consumers. It's frustrating, and we understand that. We're in a contingency, and when we started this process, it was a lot slower, and it was more difficult. It is getting better every day as we continue to improve on the notifications to individuals, as we improve some of the technology involved, as we have continue to refine the process so that it can work smoother and smoother. You know, one of the big questions that I know everybody has been asking is when will the website be up and operational? When I began it at Cover Oregon in early December, we had identified 45 critical issues with the system that needed to get fixed for that system to go become up and operational. That's what the Oracle team has been working on. And the way that the process works is those 45 critical issues get fixed and then tested, and then retested if there are still errors, and then fixed and continue to go through multiple testing cycles until they are appropriately operational. We've been able to go from 45 issues down to about 13 issues. And over the next 2 weeks, we're really going to be at a very critical point in the development of this process. Over the next 2 weeks, Oracle is entering into intensive testing on the remaining items that we need to have fixed. And I believe that based on the results of the work that goes on over the next 2 weeks, we will have a better sense of whether or not we'll have an operational website for open enrollment. There are a couple of other issues that I wanted to touch on around the IT site. You know, number one is how we're working with our current vendor, Oracle, and number two about, you know, future contingency plans, because those have certainly been a number of the questions. And I think, as you know, Oracle has been our main technology vendor. We've been relying on them to build a functioning system. We've made a large investment in this. We've invested $90 million to date, and we're working collaboratively to get that website fully launched. At the same time, I think everybody in the state and certainly everybody in this room is aware that we don't have the kind of website that we would like. We don't have the functionality and the ability to enroll people end-to-end that we contracted for. Until we have that, further payment to Oracle is contingent on a functioning website. We currently have upwards of $20 million that we have held back, and when that website is operational, those funds will be released. In addition, have hired some outside legal assistance to look at what options we have under the contract, the current contract, to hold Oracle accountable. Have brought in Greg Van Pelt to help provide some advice and assistance to me as I look to get both the enrollment and the website operational. Mr. Van Pelt has run large health plans, large health systems before at Providence Health System. One of the issues that certainly had surfaced over the last 6 months was the quality of the code and the function of the system. I've brought in a couple of additional outside experts to examine the code and look at the system function. And the last piece that we've done is also bring in some other expertise to make sure that we've got the appropriate systems in place and things are lined up so that if indeed we do fix all this, we can go live. That brings me to contingency planning. What happens if we don't have an operational website? At this point, I believe that it's still a premature question. We have, as I indicated, the ability over the next few weeks to make the changes and the fixes to have an operational website for open enrollment. But if we don't, We need to begin to look at other contingencies. We've begun to put that planning into place, contracting with some outside experts to begin to evaluate what other options we have. Can we leverage our current technology? Because as I indicated, pieces of it are working. Can we leverage some of that technology and use that in conjunction with other existing technology, such as other states' functioning enrollment systems or the enrollment system that the federal government is using right now? Or would it be possible to simply use another piece of existing technology from another state, or to use the technology that exists at the federal level to enroll people? So that's a decision that we'll look to be making over the next month. And I think most importantly, and I know I've been talking about technology, but ultimately this is really about people. It's not about technology per se. Technology is a vehicle to get people healthcare. And I think all of us as the healthcare committee know the importance of that. And it's certainly been very difficult for people over the last few months. We know that. We've had problems with the rollout. It's not been smooth. And we've been working hard at improving the processes. We've added additional customer service individuals at our call centers. We've continued to refine the process, brought in lean experts to help look at the processing of the applications to reduce cycle time, get us to the point that we can turn applications around a lot faster. We're improving our ability to notify people about where they stand in the process. That's certainly been a big issue. You know, again, when we began this process a couple of months ago, it was new. It's not as if we had an existing process, and so we've been learning. But what I do know is that as it gets better and better, we will continue to have a process that will be able to enroll people through open enrollment if the current development of the website does not work. And then simultaneously, we would begin to look at other contingencies. So that really brings me to in enrollment and where we are with in enrollment. You have a handout that details where we are with our current enrollment. We have statewide enrolled. It's actually today, because these numbers increase every day, over 180,000 people in the state into coverage. That's been through a combination of both Cover Oregon as well as the Oregon Health Authority and the work being done through Fast Track and the Medicaid enrollment. Let me break that out pretty explicitly for you. Of that, approximately 180,000, about 118,000 have been enrolled in Medicaid through the Fast Track process. And through Cover Oregon, as you can see down below, we've enrolled 42,000 people into the Medicaid program. These are individuals. Everybody submits the same application. These applications come in, and they get determined eligible for either the Oregon Health Plan or for a commercial health plan. To date, we've determined 42,000 people enrolled in Medicaid. They're over in the MMIS system at the Oregon Health Authority. And just over 23,000 people into commercial health plans through Cover Oregon. So we've enrolled over 65,000 people into coverage through Cover Oregon. And then I guess the last number on this page is we, however, have determined 95,000 people eligible for coverage. That 65 is a subset of that. We've enrolled 23,000 into commercial coverage, but we've given, in essence, another 30,000 individuals all of the information that they would need to enroll. They, at this point, have chosen not to enroll in coverage. And the question that has been asked is, why have so many people, they've applied, they've been determined eligible, they've got all of their information, why have they not enrolled to date? Our sense is it's been a number of issues. One is, since many of those people applied, there's been a big change in the insurance market, in that every one of our plans in the individual market are extending through March. So people who had coverage, they had thought that their plan was potentially going away January 1. now everybody's individual coverage has been extended through March. So it gives these individuals an additional 3 months to make their choice. And in fact, for some individuals, there's a large number of plans that have extended for the year. So many of these individuals may choose not to enroll in the Cover Oregon marketplace at this time, and may indeed wait for the future to a future open enrollment.
Did they extend at the same price and the same benefits?
Chair Greenlake, members of the committee, yes, the plans that were extended, my understanding is that they were extended at the same benefit and the same price. And every plan extended for all of the individual market plans except for OMIP and portability extended for 3 months at a minimum and some for a year.
In some cases, for less, I've heard.
I haven't seen that.
Yeah.
Everybody who calls me is paying $300 more a month than... I haven't had one person call me and tell me they're paying less.
Mm-hmm. Look at their bills.
Right. Someone who had a current plan, my understanding, it would be a good question for some others who know this more than I do, but my understanding was current coverage was extended at the same rate as what's paid in December.
For individuals.
For individuals, correct. But I think the point about that is that there are a number of individuals who applied early on who now have coverage through March and have additional time to make their decision. And the other issue that we know is that we have a lot of choice for consumers. There are 11 carriers in our marketplace, and with that comes well over 100 plans to choose from those 11 carriers, because some, you know, they have bronze, silver, gold plans. Some of them have a couple of different plans at each of those metal levels, and so there's a large amount of choice. And as we've called individuals, given them their information, and told them that they could enroll, they've wanted some additional time to make that decision, walk through that decision-making process. So we're in this, what we've been calling a hybrid process, where we're both using manual processes as well as using some of the web technology to enroll people. We've hired over 400 people to do a lot of the manual processing. That's been at a cost of about $3.3 million since we started that through January 1. That's been split between the Oregon Health Authority and Cover Oregon. Oregon Health Authority about $1.8 million. The Oregon Health Authority about $1.8 million. Cover Oregon approximately $1.5 million. On the Cover Oregon side, we are in the process of rebalancing our budget to be able to cover that within the current funding level, looking at reducing expenditures elsewhere in the budget. On the Oregon Health Authority side, there had been money budgeted for enrollment of individuals into Medicaid. And as you can see, we've enrolled 42,000 people through this process. We've been jointly working together. Those dollars that were budgeted for the health authority for enrollment, because of the fast track process, the health authority has actually seen on that side of things reduced expenditures, and so they've been able to use some of those dollars now to pay for the enrollments that are coming through Cover Oregon. We've taken a lot of steps over the last 2 months to make this process more efficient and effective. As I indicated, we've brought in some outside help to advise us on the process, have put together a management and an accountability structure between OHA and Cover Oregon to run the process. We've continued to implement a number of IT fixes that have helped make the process smoother. One that we'll hopefully be implementing in the next 2 weeks is an online application form that prompts people so that it can be complete when those applications come in. One of the issues that have made this process very difficult for consumers as well as for us has been that such a large number of applications that have come in have been missing critical information. It's a long application. It's complicated. Individuals have often not provided critical information. So what that's meant is we've had to go back, try and contact those individuals, get that information. That's added a lot of time to the process. We're at the point now, having been at this for quite a while, that we're at the point where just about every application that comes in we can deal with in real time, meaning yesterday's applications come in, today we can go through those. We can check them for completeness. If they're incomplete, we can go and try and get information from individuals. And that obviously takes time. But if those applications are complete, we can, within 24 to 48 hours, determine eligibility and get that eligibility information to individuals. As I indicated, we've brought in lean process improvement people to help advise us on the process. But this has been difficult. It's been difficult for consumers. It's been difficult for carriers. It's been difficult for agents. We've really appreciated everybody's understanding as we've worked our way through what's been, a very, very difficult time. Carriers have been great. They've been flexible. They've extended some of their payment deadlines. We've done some ability to retroactively enroll people. Continues to get better, and our goal is to get to a place where we have a website that is operational. That brings me to the last piece of this, which, before I open it up for questions, is I also gave you some revised enrollment projections. And back in late November, when the changes in the individual market were announced, and clearly we were having difficulties with the online enrollment system, again, all of the plans chose to extend for at least through March and some throughout the year. And with that and the issues with the website, the enrollment projections were revised. This is from December 4th, presented to the Cover Oregon Finance Committee. And I think as you can see on this enrollment, there was on those solid lines a mid and a low enrollment projection. And now those projections have been revised downward for a revised mid and a revised low enrollment. You know, that really, and in the end, this is an environment none of us have anticipated. My sense is we'll have the best sense of what enrollment will look like at two different points in time. One will be at the end of March, so in April, we'll have a sense. There's a large number of people who had plans extended for 3 months. We'll have a sense of enrollment at that point, but given the fact of the issues with the website and the one-year extensions, that it may not be until November and December until we have our best estimate of that. the question that has come up is what about then the financial viability of Cover Oregon? We, as you know, there is an assessment on each of the enrollments that's currently at a little over $9 per per person. And what I've been working with staff on is there's two ways to look at sustainability. One is on the revenue side, and the other is on the expense side. So we've begun to plan for, I've begun to plan for actually an additional enrollment, something that's even below the revised low enrollment level, and to look at can we reduce expenditures to the point that we are able to be sustainable at the same assessment level, but having reduced expenditures because of the reduced enrollment. If we have reduced enrollment, we should be able to reduce our expenditures. We're working through that now. I would anticipate that would mean approximately 20% reduction in expenditures out into the 2015 year. Cover Oregon, I think, as you know, is funded for 2014 solely on federal dollars, and then out into 2015 it needs to be sustainable on its own operating revenue. The last piece of sustainability about the market is, you know, the issues around the insurance market itself. Are the individuals who are signing up, who are they? Have we been able to sign up young, healthy individuals? What does the risk pool look like? And at this point in time, we don't have the demographic data around who's signed up in that first month, whether these individuals are young, old, previously uninsured, currently insured, et cetera. We'll be getting that data over the coming months and sharing that with you. You know, again, that's, you know, one of the consequences of not having the kind of real-time online operational website that we'd like to have. So, you know, with that, just let me close by, you know, again, reiterating that this is not where we want it to be as Cover Oregon, as a state, that we are working to improve the enrollment process and the way that we communicate with people. As I indicated, the next couple of weeks are going to be critical in terms of our ability to see if we can make the kind of technical fixes to have an online enrollment system in time for open enrollment. We're putting together contingency plans for if that doesn't happen. We know it can be frightening for people. Healthcare is important. There have been a lot of people who have been unable to enroll smoothly through the system and are working to make it so that everybody can enroll smoothly. And at the same time, we know that we've been able to enroll a substantial number of people and that our numbers are beginning to align with those of other states around the country. So with that, let me stop there and open it up for questions.
All right. I'm going to ask each member of the committee to have an opportunity to ask a question. I'm going to ask you to hold it in the first round at least to two questions. And if we have time left in the schedule, we'll come back and do another round. But I'm going to start with a question from Representative Tomei, who is supposed to be with us today, but is feeling under the weather. And it's on the agenda. Dr. Goldberg knows it's coming. But the issue that Representative Tomei really wanted to ask you is, how are we doing in getting vulnerable populations, particularly populations with mental health problems, but other vulnerable populations who might be eligible for health insurance under this program into Cover Oregon?
Chair Greenleck, members of the committee, In terms of vulnerable people in general, certainly our most vulnerable, amongst the most vulnerable in the state, are the lowest of income individuals. And when you look at what the Medicaid enrollment has been for the, you know, for this first month, we're, you know, as I indicated, up at close to 150,000 people. We had initially anticipated back in the spring and summer, that there would be about 135,000 individuals who came onto the Oregon Health Plan by the end of 2014. Through the fast-track process, that's clearly allowed people who needed coverage to get coverage much quicker. So I think that there's we've done a good job, a reasonable job, in getting our most vulnerable people into coverage onto the Oregon Health Plan. You know, specifically as it relates to mental illness and individuals living with mental illness and other vulnerable populations, we've had a number of grant programs to work with community partners who work with hard-to-reach populations, individuals who perhaps are isolated due to geography, due to language, special populations. So a number of grants that have gone out to those organizations. And there are, I believe, three of those grants that have gone to organizations that care for people with and work with people with mental illness. NAMI has one of those grants, the Mental Health America, I believe, and I believe actually there's four whose names I can't bring up off the tip of my tongue, but that we are working with organizations who specifically work with everyday individuals with mental illness.
Thank you. I'll start with Representative Clam, and then go to Widener, and then come back. We'll keep coming back this way. Okay. You'll be third, Representative Conger.
We start on the other
I'll
end?
Give everybody a chance to ask some questions.
I don't want to start.
Okay. You pass.
I'm not passing. I just don't want to start, sir.
We'll put you at the end. That's fine. Representative Widener, pick Thank two you. Out of that long list.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Oh.
I'll start and let it go around, but the biggest thing I'm having troubles with, we have 23,000 people that are paying premiums right now.
Chair Greenlick, Rep. Widener, members of the committee, 23,000 people, yes, who are paying.
Written a check to.
No. Not every. All those individuals have gotten their enrollment information. They, we have gotten all of their enrollment information over to the carriers, and coverage is effectuated when the premium is paid. So I do not have for you information about how many people's coverage has been effectuated. Some of the carriers have extended their deadlines for premium payment through later in the month, and as soon as individuals pay that premium, it is coverage is effective the first of the month.
So for clarification here, so out of that 23,000, those are people that probably had insurance that lost it and had to go over here, then they're not new enrollees?
Chair Greenlick, Rep. Widener, members of the committee, we don't have any information on whether those individuals were previously insured or not. Our guess is that some of those individuals were previously uninsured and some were previously insured, but I don't have a breakout of that.
And then next question would be, we do not know how many fall in that 18 to 26 year old range either.
Correct. We do not know how many fall into the 18th. We have no age demographics yet on the population that will be forthcoming.
When you do this system, because I think it's funny.
Second question now?
Well, I'm just wondering, I can call up any component out of hundreds that we sell. I can tell you how many sold in the last hour, what sold in the last day, the last month, bring you charts on everything, and we don't even know the age when we're all of this stuff. I mean, there's some
question?
Big problems here.
I think that is one of the... That's been the difficulty in having gone from a system where we had anticipated being able to have all of that information and enroll people, and we're now in a contingency, which isn't operating to the way we would like, and I would share your concern. We're not being able to get that information, and we're working to make that better all the time, and when we have an online enrollment system, we'll be able to have that kind of real-time data. We don't at this point.
But we do have more than one fax machine now.
Yes, we do.
Another question? Representative Conger?
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Back. I have another row.
I'll probably get frustrated and it wouldn't be good for me to go any further.
Bruce, at the risk of restating the obvious, this is the most incredible train wreck I think I've ever seen. It is frustrating and embarrassing for me to have voted for creating Cover Oregon, given the choice between the federal exchange and Cover Oregon, the local option, the Oregon option. I voted for the Oregon option to create Cover Oregon based in part on repeated representations from Cover Oregon's management that things were progressing along over the course of a couple of years. And to me, and I think to the public, this is just one more in a long string of broken promises by the state and federal government about health care. The end result, I think, for me, I've lost all faith in Cover Oregon. I lost all faith in Oregon's ability to fix the problems with the website. I don't believe anymore that it's going to happen tomorrow or the next day or in 6 months. And I think Cover Oregon's credibility with the public is probably destroyed irreparably, meaning that people aren't going to sign up because they don't believe it'll work, or they believe that their information will not be private, or they believe that they may think they're signing up for insurance, but they may find out they're not covered later on down the road when they need health care. All of these things lead one to the conclusion that perhaps it's time to throw in the towel. As painful as it is, maybe instead of waiting until April, which is what I think you said, when you would start looking at other options, looking at contingencies, maybe it's time to declare a loss and stop throwing good money after bad. So my first question is, how much has Cover Oregon received from the federal government and how much has been spent?
Chair Greenlich, members of the committee, Rep. Conger, we have spent $90 million up to date of federal money.
Of how much in the aggregate?
It's been $90 million total. There's another $125 million that has yet to be spent in that federal grant.
And that's all, I'm sorry, that's all the money? I've seen a lot of different numbers reported, and the last one that I saw was $304 million. So that only adds up to $215 million.
That is...
I want to understand exactly the numbers, and I feel like we're batting around different stuff and we're talking past each other. I'm not trying to...
Yeah. No,
to prosecute you right now, I just want to know the real number.
We have about $125 million left on the combination of federal grants, and we've spent $90 million to date. That's on the, I believe it's called the Tier 1 and Tier 2 grants, and I can get you the breakout on both of those in the next day. And I, Rep. Conger, share your disappointment and embarrassment and concern about this. And I would agree with you that the credibility of Cover Oregon has been certainly damaged. And, you know, my job right now is to work to do what we can to restore that credibility, but I believe it gets at the second issue that you raised, which was, you know, when is the point that we recognize that we do not have a functioning system and need to go to a contingency. I indicated earlier in the presentation that, you know, at this point, we've been able to work through a number of defects in the system, that the next couple of weeks are going to be a critical point in which Oracle will be doing a variety of testing to see if things are working. And I think over the next month, we will see whether or not we actually have a viable system. If we don't, I would agree with you that it is time to look at contingencies, and I begin to put into place, brought in some outside expertise to begin to develop the scope and the evaluation of what we would actually look at in terms of other technologies, other options, leveraging the current technology that works.
Mr. Conger, you have another question?
I do. Thank you, Mr. Chair. So, first of all, you know, I should point out, and I think you're well aware of this, that our embarrassment or our frustration pales by comparison to the cost of people who were insured, yes, who had their policies canceled, and who now are in a situation where, you know, first of all, I know of many individuals, but one in particular is always stuck in my mind, who got notice of cancellation along with the replacement policy, which would cost twice as much in premium, and had a $10,000 deductible. This is a 58-year-old woman who is a sole proprietor. She's not wealthy. She can't afford a $10,000 deductible. And then as she tried to enroll through Cover Oregon, which is what her insurance company advised her she needed to do, she couldn't afford the more expensive, less beneficial plan, she was unable to do so. And as frustrated as we all are, and as disappointed as we all are, and as embarrassed as we might be because we had faith in this, and again, I've lost all faith. I don't believe it's going to be fixed. With all of that said, it's just nothing compared to the cost of those of this debacle to those people who are the ones who were on the tip of the spear and suffered. And I want to ask you how many people who had insurance are now without a policy, but I'm going to bet you don't know the answer. I'm going to save that for the insurance commissioner later. And instead, I'm going to ask you what legal steps would be necessary to allow Oregonians to, and this is, I sent these to you this morning.
Yeah.
Hopefully you've had a chance to look at my questions, and what legal steps would be necessary to allow Oregonians to return to a market where they purchase directly from private insurers but can still avail themselves of the Obamacare subsidies?
Chair Greenlake, Rep. Conger, members of the committee, I did thank you for sending that question, and I will answer all the ones that you sent if we don't get to them today. We're researching that. I don't have a complete answer for that question. I believe that we would need to revise state statute, but I need to have some individuals do a little bit more work on looking at what both the state and the federal issues are, and hope to have that for you in the next day or two.
Okay, thank you. I would urge haste, yeah, since our session's in February, and if it does, yeah, require a change to state statute, that would be the time to do it.
Indeed.
That might be particularly possible for the small group market, too, is that right? Would you be looking at it for the small group as well as the individual?
Chair Chair Greenlake, yes. We're also looking at some other issues with the small group market, which are the ability to still be able to get individuals, small business, the opportunity for small businesses to still avail themselves of the tax credit, even though the state does not have an operating small group exchange, much as in the federal marketplace
as
well.
That's the second part of the question, I think.
We can add that to the question.
Thank you.
Mr. Lagman?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. As a new member here, I have to say this has been quite an education of a way to get my constituents ire raised so they have more conversations with me. And that's not all negative necessarily. While I understand their concerns and share their concerns, it has created an opportunity to have a lot of dialogue. So I have a lot of different questions, but two I'm going to focus on right now. The long-term goal of the website and all this is so people can go online and just be this efficient system and complete the process. But what I continue to hear a lot is the application itself, and I heard you make some comment about, I assume the complexity of the application is really created by ACA and a lot of other reasons, where you've made some changes, and I assume those changes alert people when something's not filled in or that. I'm still concerned, though, about that part of the process and people being able to use that really as the entree into ever getting to that point. As I've talked to citizens, they're just the application is a very frustrating process.
Chair Greenlake, Rep. Lively, members of the committee, the complexity of the application is extremely frustrating. There is no denying that. And certainly that application was not designed with the user-friendliness in mind.
Mm-hmm.
It was designed to comply with a whole variety of federal rules and regulations. Having said that, I do believe that there is an ability to substantially revise that application. We're in the process of doing that right now. So we're doing two things. One is we're getting an application online, hopefully in the near future, that will not allow you to submit it unless it's been completed. But more importantly, we are revising the entire application. We've had our Consumer Advisory Committee give us some input. I believe the deadline is Friday to have that final, for us to finalize a revision, and then we're going to get that to HHS in D.C. to approve, because it's been a huge problem. And we're taking steps to improve that. It can't happen fast enough from my vantage point.
I think that's your first question, wasn't it?
Mm-hmm. That was my first. So I get a second one, do I?
Yes, you do.
Thank you very much. So I want to just clarify a little bit about the cost side from the standpoint of the risk going forward and how that gets paid for. And I appreciate the $90 million that's spent. I appreciate the withhold. And I assume with the withhold, if indeed we reach conclusion of this project with Oracle, that's all that additionally get paid is what the withhold is. So I'm trying to understand, so where's the other risk to having to come up with other money other than the federal funds, especially to ultimately make this system work?
Chair Greenlake, Rep. Lively, members of the committee, further payment is contingent upon a functioning website, and so that includes the dollars that we've withheld, and then there are some additional dollars that go forth in terms of building things like the shop exchange and other things for the remainder of calendar year 2014. That is federal money. And then in 2015, Cover Oregon needs to be self-sustaining based on the administrative fee for every enrollment.
If I can just clarify, Mr. Chair. So what you're telling me at this point through 2014, we're confident that the federal funds that are available will cover whatever those costs are that we're going to need to complete this system.
Chair Greenlick, Rep. Lively, members of the committee, we are confident if we can get the system operational within the next month. I am not confident to continue that we have sufficient dollars within that to continue to pay for continued work on the system.
Okay, thank you.
Senator Kellerman, then Representative Thompson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Appreciate it. I guess I want to go just a slightly different direction, another piece of this equation, which is very complicated. And I appreciate the hard work that's been done on trying to get this non-functioning thing functioning. And I think one of the consequences has been there's been a huge emphasis on enrollment, which is in part very appropriate. But it raises another concern. And as I was looking at them, the numbers are quite disproportionate between those who are paying and those who are going on Medicaid.
Correct.
And as I was becoming alarmed about that, I received yesterday an email which contained a letter from an agent. And I'd like to read a brief segment from that because I think it raises an interesting question about that we haven't addressed, and that's the not only getting this done, but the accuracy of this. And in this letter it says, I write this letter not only as an insurance professional who is very concerned with how the rollout of the Affordable Care Act in Oregon has affected my clients and all Oregonians, but also as a very concerned taxpayer. From the time period of October 16, 2013 to December 4, 2013, I have submitted 74 applications to cover Oregon on behalf of my clients. As I write this letter, I am only aware of 19 clients who have received information on their eligibility status. Of those, 7 have been inaccurately enrolled in Medicaid based upon their projected income from 2014. That is an error rate of 36%. Now, I would say, having a background in statistics, this is not a representative sample, and it's not fair to say it's a 37%, but I guess the question I need to ask is, what are we doing to assure that those applicants that we are processing in a hurry with newly trained, very minimally trained, if I may add, quickly assembled staff, that this is being done accurately so that we actually are doing the right thing and getting what, you know, and getting accurate results? And how do we verify that?
Rep. Greenlick, Chair Greenlick, Rep. Kennemer, members of the committee, first of all, we want there to be no errors.
Exactly.
And we are doing quality checks on our accuracy rates. I have I got that same letter yesterday.
Good.
And have investigated those 7 cases, and I believe it was 7, and if I'm off by one, my apologies. 5 of those, the determination to be in the Oregon Health Plan was accurate, and the issue is that unfortunately, federal policy and some of the rules about qualification are indeed confusing and difficult. And in a couple of those cases, just to give you a sense of that, Medicaid enrollment and eligibility for Medicaid is determined based on monthly income. Your ability for the exchange and for tax credits is based on yearly income. And the way the algorithms work that we're required to work through is we first go through monthly income and then through yearly income. Some of those individuals had put down that their month's income was very low, but then they had a much higher yearly income. And indeed, based on the federal rules, looked at the monthly income, it qualified them for Medicaid. And people's incomes fluctuate from month to month. That's a big issue. We've raised that with the feds and are looking to work through that. Two of those cases were indeed errors. And both of those were errors that involved someone had submitted their application, and then it was coded and keyed in wrong. One of them, the income was left blank. Now, what should have been appropriate is to call that individual back and find out what their income was. With that appropriate income, they would not have been eligible for Medicaid. But what someone did is enter zero. And because they entered zero, that person was then eligible for Medicaid. That was an entry error. And we're working through training to not have those happen. Having said that, that these are some of the issues that we'll be able to address if we had a functioning site. We would not be relying on the 400 people that we've been trying to train and bring up and move forward. So we're working to have there be no errors. There are appeals processes for individuals who believe they have been determined inappropriately, and we can work through that with them. And we continue to work on accuracy every day as we move forward. I think ultimately this would be vastly improved by having an end-to-end solution to this, and that will help.
Do you have a second question?
I think I want to just follow up, and then okay. I'll let it go. I thank you for that correction, and I wondered about the accuracy of this as well. And I think it's still 2 out of 20 is 10%. That's a gigantic number and would have an enormous impact. So somehow we need to also add safeguards to the multitude of difficulties, and I don't envy you in this task. And thank you, Mr. Chairman, for that.
I agree.
Representative Thompson?
I'm not sure where to begin. I think we've pretty well drawn the picture. My concern is that we have prematurely launched this thing, and we are, if not in a death spiral, we're approaching it from a number of standpoints. I'm getting complaints from my constituents that they're being told their applications are incomplete when in fact they show me a copy of the application they sent in that is in fact complete. There are no unanswered questions on it. They're baffled as to why this is happening. I'm baffled. We've got another cadre of people that are in sticker shock. They get their premium projections, and they're jumping sometimes 100% from what they have been doing, and they're ending up with a $4,000 deductible, which is some kind of a cruel joke. I mean, this is not covering people with insurance. It's, I don't know what it is, but it's bizarre the way a lot of this is rolling out. We have these assignment errors that we're talking about now. And I think what we're getting on top of that we didn't measure accurately going in, is a huge air of indifference on the part of a lot of potential clients that for education, cultural reasons, whatever, they don't give a damn. And they're not going to sign up for this or anything else. They've been getting health insurance from wherever for the past 10 years. They're not interested. And then this disaster rollout just further solidifies that, so that I'm starting to question whether our projections are anywhere near accurate without taking a whip and a chair to drive people into this thing. And if we don't get those reasonable sign-ups, we're going to end up with dismal numbers that we can't support. And we talked a while back about possible 20% budget reduction. I mean, I have never heard of a state or any government agency surviving a 20% budget reduction. I think it's laudable that you would start that planning process, but this is not anything short of a tragedy. if it rolls out. I guess looking at the whole thing, I'm just wondering if this is blowing out in so many places, we can't capture back what we needed to do in a well-managed, well-planned system. And I don't blame you. I blame the feds for a lot of this because I think what we had for an exchange plan over the last few years was very good. The problem seems to have largely come about when we had to take our plan and coordinate it with federal regulations to match up, and I think it cut the heart out of some of what we were trying to do here in Oregon. But it remains, we have a disaster on our hands, and it's going to be very hard to spin this in a way that the public is going to want to get excited about it. And with the politicization here in Oregon, but even more at the national level, I think train wreck is probably a compliment in terms of where we're standing right now. And I guess my question to you would be if you have any sense of whether or not this is survivable. I mean, at what point do we go into disaster planning? What is our backup position? It's not working.
Chair Greenlake, Rep. Thompson, members of the committee, I think these are exactly the questions we have to work through in the coming months. And I think there are a couple of issues. One, as you indicated and as Rep. Conger indicated, first there's the issue of credibility. And I think the willingness of people to come through the Cover Oregon based on what's happened. And we can only speculate as to the ability to repair that credibility or not. I think what we can all agree on is it's to do so is going to certainly take a tremendous amount of hard work over the coming months. So we have a situation where there's a lack of confidence from consumers in what we've put together. There's been difficulty in enrolling. So lack of confidence, a difficult system that's been hard to get through. We've had a confusing and a changing policy environment. We have individuals who see their out-of-pocket expenditures go up, some who have seen them come down. Are we getting the right enrollment in terms of an ability to have a sustainable marketplace? I cannot predict the future, I think, any more than any of us can. We've discussed this at the Oversight Committee, and I'm putting together, the work plan over the next, through as we talked about July, that will look at what is the information we need in terms of in enrollment, the demographics of that in enrollment. Do we have an operating website? All those pieces of information to be able to make the kinds of decisions that we need to make as a state. I think we'll have a couple of checkpoints along the way. One is certainly in the next month will be, do we have a viable, is the technology we've been building viable? The other will then be about the marketplace and how viable that is, and that will come at two places. In April, we'll have a better sense of that, and then again after the summer, but certainly we need to begin to gather that information and do that analysis. So I think we're all asking the right questions, and I think those are the discussions that we'll be working through as an organization, as well as with the legislature in February and beyond.
Mr. Chair,
the skew. I mean, we're spending $220,000 to ask the question, "What went wrong?" I think we could probably solve that pretty quickly. I mean, I think most people. Get people together around a big round table, we could figure out pretty fast what went wrong and where we made assumptions that didn't work. But it seems to me we'd be better off spending $200,000 surveying the public and finding out of those people who are eligible, are they planning on coming in out of the cold, or have we poisoned the environment to the point that these projections are just nonsense because they're not going to do it? And two cases in point I ran into this weekend that I've been spending a lot of time talking to constituents about this, and I get a variety of input, but one young guy was complaining to me about he can't afford this, and I'm talking about, you know, exactly what do you mean can't afford it? His income wasn't that bad. It turns out he just bought a new Harley. He can't afford it. But so that you're not telling me you can't afford it. You're telling me you have other priorities. Your Harley's more important than healthcare. He said, yeah, bingo, absolutely. Now that guy's not coming in, and he'll probably end up paying the fine. But are we counting him in our projections? Another lady I talked to is a mother of three children. She's on all kinds of assistance programs, and there's probably some mental health issues involved, I would guess. I'm not a psychiatrist, but anyway, it comes up with her situation is she's been going to the emergency room, and it's sort of a standard. But in talking to her, I didn't get the feeling that she was planning on doing anything, because going to the emergency room has always worked, and there wasn't a connection that we should do this other thing. And somehow or other, we're missing that part, I think, of accurately predicting who's out there that will come into this expected population. And if those numbers are really low, we're in bigger trouble. And I'm not advising you what to do, except to be cautious that people are not lining up to get in. And I think we're going to have that problem for a while.
I would agree with you, and that's exactly why putting together even lower projections, and in the end, I think the one thing we would all agree on is that it's a very uncertain environment, and I'm not, and we don't know.
Okay, I know we're supposed to wrap up this part in about 6 minutes.
We are
going to
wrap up in 6 minutes.
So,
we are going
to
wrap up.
I don't even know where to start, at the big picture or the little picture. I just to build on some of the things that have been said here, the concern about low enrollment due to the website not working, that's been kind of the most publicized, I guess. The enrollment time taking too long, people not getting an answer, accuracy issues. I've sent you a couple things from my constituents that also point to customer service incredibly low. I know there's a lot of hard people out there working really hard, but the minute you have a few that treat people rudely or mess up customer numbers, they thought they had a case number and then it changed, it spreads like wildfire. And so obviously if we all want to see this work and enrollment numbers go up and it be sustainable, I would love to hear more about that. I actually don't think we have time, so I'm more asking this just for the public record, that love to know what you're doing in terms of your training and whether in your complaint system you're starting to get fewer than others. So I actually don't even want to, I'd rather get the questions out there than get the answers right now, because we will be seeing you pretty soon in a couple weeks. The other thing on this low projection, the projections were all based in terms of what's the lowest it can be and still have it be sustainable. So I'm guessing that the reason that you're giving us new numbers is this is the new projection, low, middle, and we don't have a high anymore, based on
got a very low.
Yeah, based on what could be sustainable. Because otherwise it's just like, oh, we're just going to lower the bar. So I'm guessing, because I didn't quite get that from your explanation, that that's what you meant. The other thing is, I just wanted to say,
what he meant was, if it's the low actually comes in, he has to cut 20% off his budget.
Right, that's what I mean. These numbers are based on lowering the expense side. That you think you can get away with a low projection and still make it sustainable based on cutting expenses.
Correct.
That's right. And then in terms of, you know, how are we doing compared to other states? My sense is that the Medicaid side, which I applaud as a way to get health care to more people who need it and expand our CCO population, which will enable us to do more upstream planning, seems to have gone way better than other states, and this in the Cover Oregon private side seems to have been much worse than other states.
Mm-hmm.
No? Love to have a sense of where...
We're 27th in the country, is that right?
On the private insurance enrollment.
Private insurance side.
And I'm not even sure how we can decide where that is, given that we don't know how many people have actually enrolled. this is how many that you've told.
Correct.
So I guess I would leave with that one. There's other things like performance outcomes, where was DAS on this, what can we learn for the future? These are things that I would love to, when we have more time in February. There's some really big questions here about that in terms of how government works that I think we are going to need to address. But I guess I would just love to hear a little bit in a minute, where are we compared to other states?
We are about in the middle of the pack. It depends how you slice and dice it, whether we compare to we're about 26, 27, 28 in terms of numbers of people enrolled in the private market, and that's about, we're in the middle of the pack in states in terms of population.
Enrolled meaning actually.
We don't know how many people have effectuated in terms of paid their premiums.
And none of the states.
But we also, you know, in terms of the 14 state-based exchanges, we know that we've enrolled more people than about three or four of them. Some are smaller, some are actually larger, Maryland and Minnesota. We're about at the same enrollment as they are, but they're 50-60% larger than we are. I can give you all, we have a spreadsheet of every state, their population, and their numbers of enrollment reported off of the federal numbers. We're about in the middle of the pack. There is one number that I'd like to correct, Chair Greenlick, if I might. It was a number I gave to Rep. Conger about the expenditure, and this is the problem with having a lot of numbers in my head over the last 4 weeks, and I'll get you an actual accounting. The $90 million that I said we spent, that is what we've spent, but that's the dollars we've spent on just on Oracle, our contractor. We've spent some additional dollars, and let me, so I don't off the top of my head give you another number. I will get you all of the grant funding, what's been spent to date total on the federal grant, and what remains to be spent, and my apologies. Trying to get all of the finances in my
head. I'd very much like to have that in the record, including OHA money.
I will.
Send it to all of us.
Yes. I will get that to Sandy and get it.
Senator Clem, you have about 2 minutes.
All right, well, I'll go quick. So, Bruce, these aren't necessarily, you know, questions for right now, but I don't want to throw in the towel and go back to the old system. No way. Old system, as I said before, was, I'm not going to use the same word, but it was terrible. It resulted in people being falsely declared dead, all kinds of terrible things. Now, you want to talk about going forward to a different system like a public option that some of us wanted in the first place, Medicare for All? Yeah, I'll talk about that. But you want a train wreck was Microsoft Avista. That was a real train wreck. All my customers for like 4 years, I couldn't let them upgrade their software. So I want us to make Oracle do this at their expense. They're a very big company. They had, I'm looking at their profit, $10 billion last year in net income. Make them deliver the product we paid them for. That's what I want.
Would agree with you and have people helping us look at what our options are so that we can assure that we get an operating system.
Bruce, I want to thank you. Your pessimism makes me feel much more optimistic. Rocky's optimism always made me pessimistic. So
I'm glad I made you feel better. I hope you can return the favor.
I want to say two things. One is, whenever I've had a constituent problem, your staff has been remarkably quick to get it taken care of. And in fact, most of the problems that I've seen in the few constituents I've had that I've had to refer to you, maybe half a dozen or so, is that they were okay. They just didn't know they were okay. And that's a big problem. Getting people information, getting them enrolled in health plans, and then letting them know they've been enrolled so they don't sit there. I mean, I put the application in October 1st. It's December 22nd. It's past the deadline. I don't know what the hell's happened. We find out what's happened is they've been found eligible and they've been enrolled, but they didn't know that yet, so it's important to get them. I'm cautious yet. I think we should wait till the 31st of March, the end of the open enrollment period. We'll know where we are. My impression is we'll have a ton of people involved. I think your Medicaid work has been remarkable, although you can't take any responsibility for that anymore. We'll talk to Tina about that. But my impression is, as an Oregon taxpayer, I think we've pumped about $1 billion next year into Oregon's economy on the basis that 150,000, I think maybe
correct,
a little over $1 billion. If we can just find the doctors and the nurses to get the checks to spend.
We didn't get to that part.
It'll be helpful. Bruce, thank you very much.
Thank you.
I'm going to close this session. While we have everybody here, is Brian still here?
Yeah.
While we have everybody here, I'm going to open a work session specifically for the purpose of introducing the three LCs that we have. Remember, introducing an LC doesn't endorse it in any way. It's the three that we've heard about. One is, let's see, I remember. One is the demonstration on DME. One is a bill on, is an LC that we're introducing, so we'll have a nice relating to clause. We're probably not going to take the prison health one. And the third one is for a study of the basic health plan. We'll introduce those three, and we'll see where they go when we get into session. Can I have a motion?
Did you open a work session, sir?
I will open a work session for the purpose of introducing
which study,
LCs as committee bills.
We don't have a single hair.
Oh, that's not in here this time.
Mr. Chair, there seems to be, if I may, provide a second of clarification.
Yep.
LC 158 is relating to a study of alternative approaches to financing health care for the basic health plan.
Right.
It directs OHA to conduct a feasibility study, an independent feasibility study, on if Oregon can go into another basic health plan program similar to Washington. And that is LC 158. I think you might...
Mr. Chair, if I may, can I ask that we take LC 158 as a separate issue instead of doing all three together?
Sure. Let's have a motion on the other two.
Okay. Chair Greenlee, I move the following LCs be introduced as committee bills: LC 66, dated 1/13/14, and LC 159, dated 12/2/13.
Representative Thompson moves that LC 66, dated 1/13/14, and LC 159, dated 12/2/13, be what?
Introduced.
Be introduced as committee bills. Is there any objection?
Or any question?
Discussion.
Discussion? Yes.
Relating to clause is awfully large here. Do you want this to...
I'm sorry.
It has a big relating to clause, relating to health care.
That's the one.
Yeah. That's just checking to make sure that's the one you want, because...
That's the one we want. Have at it. We'll have some... It's possible we'll have some amendments to that bill. Any objections? Hearing none, so moved. Representative Kenny Geyer, can I have a motion for you from you on
158.
LC 158.
Chair Greenlee, I move that the following LC be introduced as a committee bill: LC 158, dated 1/9/14.
Representative Kenny Geyer moves LC 158, dated 1/9/14, be introduced as a committee bill. Any discussion? Representative Thompson?
No, I just wanted to leave this open because I understand there may be somebody who doesn't want to support that bill.
Voting for this is not supporting the bill.
Yeah,
let's make that clear. But if somebody wants to vote against introducing it, that's good too. Are there any objections to this?
All right.
Would you call the roll, please?
Representative Plim?
Yes.
Representative Palmer?
No.
Representative Parker?
Excuse.
Representative Kenner?
Aye.
Representative Lively?
Aye.
Representative Widener?
No.
Vice Chair Kenny Geyer?
Aye.
Vice Chair Thompson?
Aye.
And Chair Green?
Motion passes. Thank you for separating. That's appropriate.
Aye.
Oh, I am an aye, yes, for the record. Do you have to move for reconsideration to get my eye on the floor? No, good, okay.
Committee intent works here.
Our closed the work session and open up an information session on Oregon Health Authority update, including progress on coordinated care organizations. And we have a director of the authority, I guess acting director of the authority, and a couple of wing persons. Text you. I've asked Tina to give us some information about how OHA is going. I've assumed she's been able to take the opportunity to improve things now that she doesn't have the anchor of the former director around. But then to ask specifically the question about how CCOs have been going. So, and let's try and stick to the schedule if we can.
Okay. Chair Green, members of the committee, thank you so much. For the record, my name is Tina Edlund, and I am the acting director for the Oregon Health Authority. And with me today, I have... Please introduce yourself.
Janet Meyer with Health Share of Oregon.
And Jeff Hetherington with Family Care.
So what I'm going to do, I actually just gave a form of this presentation over on the other side of this building and found out that it actually takes almost a full 30 minutes just for me to go through my section, and I don't want to use up all the time.
You can talk faster here. We're quicker than
you're quicker than they
are. Yeah, would you please let them know?
So what I'm going to do, since this committee, the first part of this presentation is about what we're seeing in the CCO data. I'm not going to go into that too deeply, mainly because you've seen this data before. The new progress report comes out at the beginning of February, and you've seen this data. So I am going to go ahead and start on page 3 of the, if you have the same handout I do, you have single pages. So what we are seeing so far, the slide that starts with that. And so I can just hit the high points for you, that what we know from the data so far in this first year of operation is that every CCO is living within its global budget. The state is meeting its commitment to reduce Medicaid spending trend on a per-person basis by the 2 percentage points. The state-level measures of on quality, utilization, and cost show promising signs of improvement. And the caveat that as you look at this data, that this we don't expect this to be linear. We do expect things to have some little ups and downs. But I can tell you I've taken a peek at the new data that I'm starting to evaluate right now, and the trends are continuing. We're really heading in a good direction. So that's really encouraging. The most recent activity that I think is short of ACA implementation, Affordable Care Act implementation, is dental integration. We have just achieved, I think, a huge milestone with the CCOs. In December, we moved over 240,000 enrollees into fully integrated CCOs. This is really pretty impressive, given that the statute does not require dental integration until July of this year. So we have 10 of 15 of the CCOs that have integrated dental care. And that, and 5 are left. They didn't feel ready to integrate yet. So I think that's also a really encouraging sign of increasing integration in the system. ACA implementation. We have, I think, probably the first thing. Some of these things just don't really appear compared to the discussion about enrollment. I think a really important aspect of ACA implementation is that we now have one benefit package, and we've gotten all the approvals from CMS. We no longer have the OHP standard and OHP plus. That OHP standard, if people remember, had a really pretty skinny hospital benefit. So the entire population now is on OHP plus, which is really encouraging. Enrollment numbers, and what I have here, I actually have a slide that shows you, if you look ahead to the one with the table on it, it shows you the ACA enrollment by CCO.
as of a few days ago, that this is what it looked like. The total enrollment in Medicaid from the ACA is about 160,000 new members. About 42,000 of those came through from Cover Oregon. When we talk about a broken system on Cover Oregon, the odd thing is that the part that does work is actually the eligibility system, and we do use that part of that system for eligibility determination. So there, the 42,000 of those have come over from them to us, and the remaining 118,000 are part of the Fast Track program, which was a program that we actually got a waiver from the federal government to take people who were already qualified for food stamps for the SNAP program. They've gone through exactly the same eligibility criteria. They have to be citizens. Their income is checked, all of those things. Those that were below 138% of poverty and were in the SNAP program, we were able to send a letter directly to them and say, you already have gone through all the requirements, checking of all the requirements. If you want health care too, sign this, send it back, and we can enroll you.
So just a question for clarification. It had 95,000 here for that, and you're saying 118,000?
Right.
It was 95 plus 42.
Well, the 42 comes from what came through the Cover Oregon portal, and the other was the Fast Track.
The 118 is the Fast Track. Now,
the number was gone up since the 95,000 on the sheet that we were just getting.
Right, right.
So that's the 150.
Right, it's 160,000 now, and there's always going to be some difficulty matching up numbers precisely, because the numbers I use, I don't count anything until it's actually in our MMIS system, because there's so many ways, as it moves along the process. If you count it at any point in the process, it's really hard to know that you don't have duplicated numbers and all kinds of complications.
Numbers are 118,000 in your system from the Fast Track, and the 42,000
are in our
system,
and they came over from Cover Oregon. That's right.
Yes.
So I think one of the questions that I get asked all the time, and I don't have a perfect answer for this, and Jeff and Janet might address a little bit in their comments, is the issue of access, that we have 160,000 new people coming into the system, and access might be a problem. I won't say that I have the magic bullet or have the answer to that question, but we have done some things to try and address the access issue in the state. We have a loan repayment program for primary care providers who are willing to see Medicaid clients. We've really emphasized patient-centered primary care homes using a team-based approach so that you really can maximize the ability of a team to see patients. We have increased the number of community health workers in the state so that we can increase capacity that way, not using their time to do some of the really important kind of work to do asthma screening and those kinds of things, so that we have less of those kinds of visits. We have our tax credit program. We have a really strong network of federally qualified health centers. I think some of the work of the Oregon Health Study showed us that about 50% of the new people coming in already had a regular source of care. They were being seen in federally qualified health centers, so they weren't all brand new to the system. They didn't have insurance coverage. They didn't have particular continuity of care, but they did have access to care. The other piece before I go on to the issue of mental health integration and what it looks like on the ground here is the other, I think, really important program that we're undertaking on a very short-term basis is the temporary medical insurance pool. As you are all probably aware, the Oregon medical insurance pool went away statutorily on December 31st of this year, the thinking being that we didn't need it anymore. But with the struggles that the exchanges had, it was really pretty clear that we needed, that this was a group who might fall through the cracks, that they're very vulnerable, high-need people. So what we did was we found out that we had the capacity within the Oregon Health Authority to create a temporary program, to create a home for them, basically send out notifications that they could continue their coverage. We worked with the care with Regents. They could continue their coverage if they paid their premium by today. So we are looking at that. We're working, actually we worked in collaboration with legislative leadership in order to establish that approach, and we will be working together during session to make sure that the appropriate authorities are in place. But that is, again, it's a short-term program. We'll be moving as fast as we can to find homes, to find coverage for those people who sign up for this program. We know it's probably about, it's going to be somewhere around half of the 10,000 people who are in there, because we do know where about half of them went, that they, about 2,300 went into Medicaid, 2,500 into Cover Oregon and got coverage that way. And then we know a handful went directly to the market. So that's, you know, that's just one of the things that we have been working on. Now to get to the I think probably one of the really interesting and unique things happening here is the new mental health investments that the legislature invested about, what is it, $40 million in new community mental health investments in the state. We moved very rapidly toward issuing RFPs out to local communities to respond in the areas of mental health promotion, children's mental health, and adult mental health, to really try to strengthen that system. People responded very quickly. The 85% of the decisions have been made. The announcements actually, I think, go out hopefully by the end of this week. And we'll see how it's distributed. It's really statewide. I think there's only, I think it's across the entire state.
Great.
A couple of those in those areas, actually, those investments went directly to CCOs, assertive community treatment, which provides case management for people with serious mental illness, helps them avoid hospitalization, was made available for CCOs to apply for, and then the children's system of care wraparound services for children was also another funding source in these new investments that was made available for CCOs to apply for. I think that will be their performance metrics included in every single one of these contracts. It'll be really interesting to watch the impact of those new investments. It's an exciting time. I've gone through this really fast, but I really did want to get to what I think is the highlight of the presentation, and that is to be able to hear from the chief executives of two of the two CCOs in the Portland metropolitan area, to hear about how mental health integration is actually occurring at the ground level, at the CCO level, and how that's working. I didn't do an order of show. Which one of you would like to go first?
I want to object to your statement. You're clearly the star, Tim.
Oh. Thank you.
Would you rather be part of Cover Oregon?
She's just relieved she wasn't assigned to Cover Oregon.
I think you ought to watch that she didn't ask to answer any questions either.
We'll ask a question.
Sorry.
Who's going first?
I'll go first. Chair Greenlick, members of the committee, thank you for this opportunity to share part of HealthShare's transformation story. For the record, my name is Janet Meyer, and I'm the CEO of HealthShare of Oregon. We're a coordinated care organization serving 185,000 Oregon Health Plan members in Clackamas, Multnomah, and Washington counties. I get a lot of questions about what is HealthShare that were very complex, and the one thing that all CCOs have in common is that we reflect the communities that we work in, and HealthShare reflects the very complex healthcare delivery system that exists in the greater Portland metropolitan area. We were founded by 6 integrated health systems, specialty referral systems, 3 county mental health organizations, and many, many community organizations. Our goal is to improve the outcomes of our population through a regional system of care in the Tri-County region. I want to talk a little bit about what we've been doing in behavioral health specifically, because as you know, our membership, the Oregon Health Plan, has a higher rate of mental illness and addiction battles. And so we really needed to focus on that right out of the gate. And one thing we've been doing is we've worked with all three counties to create a regional system of care around outpatient mental health. I'll give you an example. When HealthShare arrived on the scene, the three counties combined had 300 different types of service authorizations that the providers were required to pursue to get service authorization. Today they have 20. So we went from 300 to 20 by working together as a regional system of care to standardize the process so our members get care rapidly. One of the other issues we hear about from our primary care providers is access to what we call specialty mental health. Some mental health can and should be taken care of in the primary care home. Some clients need specialty mental health, and we've been really focused on that specialty mental health system, that we're getting the right people to the care at the right time and in the right place. One of the things we've done is establish standardized levels of care that are based on evidence that we're working with the providers to treat to a target so we get the outcomes we want. So we've changed the way we pay for outpatient mental health as of January 1. That's not enough. You can't just change the way you pay. You have to also help the providers change the clinical care model. So we've been running boot camps and webinars and out there on the ground working with the mental health specialty providers to change their clinical model that works within the new payment model. So we're very proud of that. The other thing we've done is with the transformation funds that were so generously awarded by last session's legislature, two of our projects involve mental health very directly. One is an advanced primary care model. Some of our primary care homes have a high degree of serious people with serious and persistent mental illness and have a lot of patients with addiction issues. So we're taking the patient-centered primary care home and we're really developing what we call advanced primary care. And that really is a specialty system in primary care so that these clients can get the best care possible in the primary care home. And we support the primary care providers in raising up their ability to serve this population. So we have an advanced primary care collaborative that we're very excited about. We have a few clinics that are participating, and once we finish our proof of concept, we'll expand it. Another project through the Transformation Fund was something called Project Echo, which uses a telemedicine model to really provide support to primary care providers who are treating a lot of complex patients. This model was actually developed in New Mexico around hepatitis C treatment and how could specialists support primary care providers in hepatitis C. It was then taken to Seattle. University of Washington did it around pain medication management. That's proven to be very successful. So HealthShare has included that as part of our Transformation Fund projects to bring the Project Echo model to the Tri-County region and see if we can support our primary care providers by giving them the specialty support that they need, whether it's psychiatric medication management or pain medication management. Both of those are big issues. It's very similar to the state's expansion of OPAL-K, which is a telemedicine referral type model that supports providers who are treating young children with the high dose mental health medication. Finally, the last thing I wanted to share with you was we submitted, Tina was talking about the community health investment, which is very exciting. We actually submitted three grant applications. One was for an assertive community treatment program that will be culturally specific to the American Indian Alaskan Native population. We believe if we get the award, it will be the first culturally specific assertive community treatment team in the nation. We believe, certainly for Alaskan Natives, American Indians. So we're very excited. We've also applied for an assertive community treatment team that's called a Forensic Act, and it's for people with criminal justice involvement, the people that are cycling through our jails and prisons with a lot of mental health and addiction issues to try and get services wrapped around them, catch them when they're released from incarceration and try and break that cycle. So we're excited about that. We've also applied for wraparound funding for Tri-County. We have wraparound funding for the children's in Washington County, and we're expanding it to Multnomah and Clackamas if we get the award. So thank you very much for listening. I'm happy to answer questions after Jeff.
Jeff, I think we're not going to have much time for questions. You've been very
clear. I can talk right through that. my name is Jeff Hetherington. I'm the president and CEO of Family Care. We are the other CCO in the Portland Tri-County area. Family Care is a nonprofit organization. We were formed in 1985. We've been doing mental health integration with the physical health program since 1997. So part of the assimilation of a mental health into our program was fairly easy. But first of all, we had our networks already established, and so some of the angst you hear with the other CCOs we've not had to endure because we'd been through it earlier. Not that it wasn't some angst at the time. A couple of things, and I'll try and leave a little time for questions, we've done a few things new. I could talk about things we've done since 96. A couple of things we've done with the new things: we've funded grants for our larger clinics to have co-located mental health people in their mental health professionals in their clinics. The co-location of mental health people in clinics is not necessarily winning proposition financially for them, so because there isn't the patient load within these clinics to keep someone busy full time, but you sort of need someone there full time to take the cases as they come, because it's easier to walk people down the hall than it is to refer them in a lot of cases. That's not possible in the small clinics, but we have developed a couple of payment models where the larger clinics can co-locate the mental health people as they go into their clinics. Our bigger initiative is to make sure that, frankly, that the primary care providers on both sides know each other. It's amazing to me, no matter how small or how large the clinic, what we assume is community knowledge isn't in the medical field. Little towns like Pendleton, we introduced school nurses to the primary care doctors a couple of years ago. They didn't even know they existed. You know, people get so siloed these days that the mental health professionals don't know the primary care medical people. And so putting them together and, frankly, getting them to know each other face-to-face, talk about their different approaches to care, who they take care of, you know, is probably the greatest effort that we have made, because, frankly, it's the relationship among the providers that helps things move quicker than anything we can do just within the CCO. We have one special program we're working with the Asian Health and Service Center in terms of overall culturally competent care, you know, that we see as being a tremendous help to that group, because that is the largest ethnic population in the city of Portland, aside from the Hispanic population. And so we're working very closely with them, not only on the physical but the mental health side, and particularly with the older Asian population. The thing that we did, which we think is probably going to be the most helpful to both the providers and to the patients, is we as an insurance company, we run with silos. We have a claims department, a referral and auth, and so on. We have reorganized the entire company based on integrated service teams. And so it's a one-stop shop for the providers or the patients. Our teams are assigned a certain number of providers who are attached to their assigned patients. And so either the patient or the provider when they call in. They all get the same people every time. And frankly, building the relationship between the insurance company team and the provider team makes things a lot quicker and a lot easier. So we have people who concentrate on the children's clinics, people who concentrate on the adult clinics only, and people who concentrate on family practice. It's a lot more complicated than that, but all of the disciplines are taken care of within that team, as are all the administrative functions that a provider or a patient would need to access. So, you know, we just have started rolling that out a couple of months ago. We'll be glad to see how it applies as we move forward. I think it's going to be quite well received. The problems that we have faced...
I have to wrap it up, Jeff.
Huh?
So I have to ask you to wrap it up.
Wrap it up. I will very quickly. The biggest problem we have is a shortage of primary care, both in mental health, dental health, and physical medicine. And it would sure be nice if we could get the legislature to help us with that.
Not the first time we heard that. I heard this morning in the higher ed committee.
I've been saying that since 1979.
Mr. Chairman.
Yes, very briefly.
Yes, I also was a recipient of a phone call from a very ill Representative Tomei yesterday.
Right. I was going to say the same thing.
Okay. I think it was particularly to this group, and I'm sorry she wasn't well enough to be here and hear the presentation, because it sounds like you're doing more than I was aware of. But she has some very serious concerns that we are not up to adequate speed in meeting federal standards in mental health, and in particular in community wraparound services. And I want to convey that to you. I'm not sure of its accuracy, and I would encourage you to have some conversations with her. And it's an interesting overlap between her social services committee and our healthcare committee in this way we've historically divided the mental health field. But I wanted to pass that message on and keep faith with the good representative.
Can I say, I'll just follow
very,
on
very
that.
Briefly, and then
very briefly, because I'm going to see her at 8. I'm going to be on her committee at 8 a.m. tomorrow.
We hope she'll be there.
I hope she's here. She's got the flu. As you know, she's passionate about this, so she sent this to all of us, the U.S. Department of Justice interim report to the state of Oregon about the integration of community mental health in compliance with Title II of the Americans with Disabilities Act. So we'd love to hear more progress. You mentioned some of the things. I know there was $5.8 million for children and young adults for mental health. You talked about the RFP and the applications that came in. $10 million for housing and peer-delivered services. This came out of our special session. You know, I'd love to hear once you've made those decisions, maybe you could send a copy to us and Representative Tomei. She also had a question about the residential programs that are supposed to be integrated into the CCOs this summer. Not asking you to answer all these now, but maybe she can be with us in February, and if you could have that as part of your report.
Happy to do that.
Well, also, she also raised an important question that we're going to take up separately, and that's the question of the extent to which the CCOs are affecting the safety net of people who aren't CCO members, and the issue of the relationship between the CCOs and the safety net. We'll get to that in February, because that's an important issue that needs its own time.
No.
Senator Wyden?
You may not have this. If you could leave it by my office, would be great. But of the 42,000 people that have been referred to you from the Cover Oregon, can you give me the age group? How many of those are between the age of 18 and 26 versus 26 to 35 and so on? So I can get an idea of what we're looking at for enrollees that are coming out of Cover Oregon to the CCOs. And then it'll help us know what's going on a little better, because a lot of these 18 to 26 year olds can be covered on their parents' policies too under federal law. So,
Representative Widener, I'd be happy. I don't have it with me, but I'll be happy to get that for you.
Yeah. Thank you.
Representative Thompson?
I don't want an answer to this question today, because I'm going to ask it in February, but I'm a very impatient person, as you sometimes know, and I understand the policy planning and organization phase is very important, but when are we going to get down to diagnostics and treatment? Specifically, we have an incredible problem in this state with meth addiction. What is our program, if we have one, and when will we have one,
to address meth addiction in those patients, and how do we deal with that? We haven't been very successful in the past. So it's one thing to say we're going to handle mental health and addictions, and we're getting all these wonderful things going, and everybody's getting in line, but patient number one is going to come through the door, and hopefully we'll send 500 more right in behind them. What do we do with those patients we have not been successful with in the past? Because now we've agreed under ACA for measurable outcomes, and I wouldn't want to see us 5 years from now with just as many meth addicts as we have right now, and they're the same people. That's not going to work well.
Representative Thompson, members of the committee, I'd be happy to put together a more thorough response to that question, and we could come back to you.
No, I don't want to. I know you wouldn't know today, but just that's the direction I want to go. I want to see some specifics.
Chair Greenlee, could I respond just briefly to the USDOJ report?
Very briefly, please.
So the USDOJ sent out.
It's all right. We can take out the time for the next session.
Yeah. So the USDOJ, that report is part of a 5-year agreement with USDOJ. It was the first year. We, as a result of that report, as part of that report, we spent 2 days with them last week, meeting with them. At the time, we were also able to take a lot of information to them. They weren't aware of the community mental health investments. They weren't aware of where we were making the investments. They came away. They'll be sending a letter about where they think we are, and I'm sure they'll still push us.
It wasn't included.
But they came away. They told us that they were really encouraged. They were really encouraged by the new leadership in AMH. They were really interested to hear what's going on at the CCO level. So I think we'll see something better. I mean, I think we still have a long way to go, but I do think we'll see something better.
I want to make one comment so that the committee is clear about one thing. A lot of the wraparound services, and particularly the safety services, are not part of our global budget.
Well, that's clear. The question is, how do we get them?
Well, we're getting a lot of pressure on that, just so you know, and the fragmentation there. I think there's a lot of real careful planning that has to be done as you... If you intend to put them into the CCOs, that's not part of our charge yet.
I don't think the question
other,
is.
And the other part is we
I
don't have control
Jeff,
of the
I think
trucks.
We understand that, and I think Representative Tomei is interested in how we figure out how to link the CCOs to the places, housing, jobs, other kind of thing, food supplements, other things are, and how we work together with those links. I don't think anybody's expecting you to have this as a part of your current capitation.
Well, there
I'm going to have to close the session. Before I do, I want to announce, finally, I've announced before that we're going to have a work group getting ready for the 2015 session on the role of the community advisory groups, assessing them, seeing where there are. Representative Thompson, Representative Lively is going to co-chair that work group. Our committee administrator has a list of folks that have asked to be on it. She's going to be contacting people between now and the first week in February. We'll hope we'll have that work group going the first week of February so we can see how things are going, for better or for worse. Thank you. I'll close this informational hearing. Tina, don't go away.
I know.
I'm going to open an informational hearing and ask our insurance commissioner to join you and talk briefly on the recommendations for aligning the Affordable Care Act, the Oregon Health Policy Board's recommendations to the insurance commissioner, and seeing how you guys are linked.
Mm-hmm.
If you'll give us a brief update on that, please.
Absolutely. Representative Greenlee, members of the committee, for the record, I'm Tina Edlund, the acting director of the Health Authority.
And I'm Laura Calley. Chair Greenlee, members of the committee, I'm Laura Calley, the insurance commissioner for Oregon. Thank you.
So I'll make this very fast, which means I'll be skipping through this presentation.
Yeah,
as
we
well.
Have about 10 minutes.
Okay. So the governor was really interested in the next steps of health reform in this state and how we make sure, I mean, we could spend a lot of time enrolling people into a system that that doesn't work very well. It doesn't drive, doesn't work at driving down costs overall. He asked, what he did was write a letter to the board, basically, and gave them a charge to be looking at how you might, as the ACA is implemented in the state, how you might mitigate any cost shifts that would result from that, how you actually might decrease the growth trend in healthcare premiums, and in the overall, it's an item that's not on here, in the overall cost of healthcare in the state, much like we've done in Medicaid and now in PEB, how we would increase transparency and accountability, and how we might enhance the rate review process in the state. I'm going to skip pages here with some of the background. So some of the things that we looked at were how do we align contracting across PEB and OEB and cover Oregon and the individual and in the individual market and with large employers. Right now, what we've done in PEB was very much like we have done with the coordinated care organizations in Medicaid. Was in our RFP, we actually outlined the characteristics of what coordinated care is and how we think it's defined, and asked people to submit in their response to the RFP how they would deliver services that met those coordinated care principles and coordinated care requirements. Well, how do you spread that model out in the commercial market? It's a much more difficult problem to look at. And how do you use the rate review process to drive some of that? So the recommendations of the board, I mean, they looked at a lot of things. They looked at some fairly aggressive programs in other states, and in Rhode Island particularly. They have a pretty aggressive way of using the rate review process to control the growth of premiums. Where we landed, again, I think because we're in the middle of a huge implementation process in the state, was the board recommended that we spend some time actually developing a measurement framework. We look at how costs are growing in the state, and where is it growing in the state? What parts of the healthcare system are increasing in costs at what rates? Look at it by market segment. Really start to get a handle on a framework so that we can actually analyze and look at the changes that we might want to make. Excuse me. Go ahead,
Tina, if I may. I think the other piece too is to try to make sure there's as much alignment as possible with the data that OMJ is collecting and the data that we're seeing through the rate review process, so that we can try as much as possible to make some apples to apples comparisons, and also understand if you're looking at things kind of at a system wide level or a provider level, how is that translating to when when our team through the insurance division is looking at an insurer's rate filing. So how do you actually marry those data sets and understand, you know, if they're telling you the same story and it's consistent? So, you know, we're trying to kind of drive toward more of a collaborative and consistent use of data.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you'll notice as you look at these recommendations that in many places it's the recommendation is that OHA and the insurance division work together to develop standards and measurement specifications and actual metrics themselves so that we can get some alignment across the two agencies. On the cost containment piece, what the board became very interested in is the whole idea of a sustainable rate of growth. Again, in Medicaid, we can do it. We have some control in Medicaid in terms of, you know, we control the budget. So it's not easy, but it's something that you can actually implement in Medicaid. Doing that in the commercial market is a whole different issue. So what they recommended was that we spend a year working with stakeholders and partners and think about how we might develop a methodology for how you might achieve a sustainable rate of growth in the commercial market. The direction to OHA actually was, and OID, was to put together a work group made of these stakeholders and come back at the end of this year with a recommendation and recommendations if they feel like there's any legislation necessary in order to make it happen. It would include actually recommending what that growth rate would be. Is it tied to the growth of income in the state? Is it tied to the state's the state equivalent of a gross national product? To make a recommendation around that and what might work. So it's really exploratory and developing a methodology. It was really important to the board and to the groups we worked with that this not just look at premium growth, because premium growth obviously reflects the underlying cost of medical care, that you also need to look at the provider side. Did you want to add?
Sure, and actually add just a couple of thoughts to that. So I think, you know, Tina was alluding to this whole total cost of care notion. Mm-hmm. You know, we see premiums. We want to understand how that actually marries up when you think about the cost of providing services. Also, when you think about the insurance division's rate review, we see a portion of the market. We see small group and individual. So we want to understand kind of how this is looking system-wide. And we also wanted to have a way to hold healthcare entities accountable. So that's actually going to be part of the work that's done throughout the year, is not just what should the methodology for defining that rate of growth look like, but how do you actually hold this group of people or this group of organizations accountable to achieve that rate of growth.
Good. The last major strategy was to really look at how you might enhance the growth of enhance the rate of primary care and preventive care in the state, that the healthcare system actually invests more in primary care and preventive care than it has historically. Again, using Rhode Island as an example, what they actually look at in the rate review process is what percentage of a health plan's book of business basically goes toward primary care, and they look toward it growing as a percentage over time. The board wasn't willing to go there in a recommendation right now, but they do want us to look at those kinds of avenues and potential approaches, and to not focus too much on one single model. I think that those are the three major strategies: the transparency piece, the sustainable rate of growth piece, and the investment in primary care. They also had some recommendations around how the insurance division might enhance transparency for consumers. I'll let Laura talk about that, because what they actually discovered was there are quite a few activities that are already beginning within the insurance division, and Laura can just speak to that.
Sure, and I'll be brief, but there's actually concerned a number of different issues, and I started to actually talk about this in terms of how we use data. So looking at things like, are we already collecting some of the data in other places that we're asking insurance companies to submit?
I'm going to interrupt here.
Sure.
I really want to thank you for introducing me. This is such an important topic that I'm going to ask you to come back in February.
Okay.
Where we'll allot a fair amount of time for it. I think this may be the most important topic we're going to be dealing with once we get Cover Oregon straightened out, and I'd like a lot more time for us to examine. I know there's some disappointment on some parts that the recommendations were very mild, they weren't very stringent, but we'll schedule some time in the second part of the February session and give you a chance to really have a chance to interact with us and spend some time.
Chair Greenlick, we'd be happy to.
It is a really urgent one.
Happy to do that.
I just hate to cut it short.
Yeah,
so
yeah.
We'll just consider this the appetizer, and we'll have the full meal in February.
Okay.
I thank you very much for introducing it to us.
Our pleasure.
I'll close this session, and we'll ask the commissioner to hang in for a minute. We'll open the session on the issues of... on the discrimination provisions. We've had some folks on the committee interested in talking to you about those, and perhaps if you had a brief moment to introduce them, we'll see. I know we have some questions for you.
Happy to do so. So again, Chair Greenlick, members of the committee, for the record, I'm Laura Calley, and I'm the insurance commissioner. So I'm here to talk a little bit today about the issue of provider non-discrimination and the requirements under under federal law. So I'm just going to briefly just state the issue. I'm not sure how familiar you all are with it, but I'll kind of state what the issue is and what we're planning to do from here on out in terms of implementation. Basically, there's a clause in the federal law, so this is in the Affordable Care Act and the Public Health Services Act, that says that basically health plans cannot discriminate with respect to coverage or participation for providers who are acting within the scope of their license. And there's some other other information included in that clause too, but there's quite a bit of discussion about what constitutes discrimination, how do you actually look at discrimination in the context of participation or coverage, and how do you marry that up with looking at, you know, what a particular provider is licensed to do in terms of providing healthcare services. So we've had a lot of discussion with various stakeholders, including members of the provider community, so ranging from what people tend to think of as the more traditional providers, MDs, DOs, NPs, but also some from other parts of the provider community, including naturopaths and chiropractors, about what this means and what kind of the, you know, the operational reality of this is going to be now that we're here in the land of health reform implementation. And we've also talked, of course, with insurance companies, because they're the ones who are required to comply with this and show, demonstrate to us as the insurance regulator that they are in compliance. So a lot of discussion going on around this, and where we are right now is we're about ready to issue some draft guidance, looking to do that at the end of the month. It's going to point back to this federal statute and basically say, here's the statute, and we as the insurance division, we're the primary regulator. We are charged with overseeing this. We will be looking at this. We will be monitoring for compliance with federal law, and we will be also taking this up in the coming months in the context of network adequacy, because we see this as really interlinked with, do you have a sufficient number of providers or a sufficient provider network, so to speak, to deliver the care that you're, that you as an insurance company are covering for people. So this is linked in terms of how you're looking at whether discrimination is occurring. So we think that this is something we need to talk about in that context of network adequacy in the coming months. And so we'll have this guidance out there. We'll start the conversations with the same set of stakeholders about network adequacy. We plan to come back and talk to you next year in 2015 about network adequacy. But in the meantime, we still are charged with...
You can talk to us before that.
Well, we certainly will. But I think the idea is that we do plan to come back with a concept for 2015 about how we'll implement network adequacy. But along the way, we still need to be monitoring for compliance today. I mean, this is something that took effect in 2014. So we're going to be using our existing market regulation function. We have a consumer complaint system right now that, you know, people call in, they'll raise issues that they're experiencing with their insurance company, and we have been seeing more issues come through from providers as well. So we plan to use that same process where if there are concerns regarding discrimination coming from consumers, coming from providers, we'll take them through that process. We'll investigate as appropriate, and we'll take that through our market regulation process if we see that there are some areas for concern. We do think this is really important. We want to make sure that people do have access to care and access to the benefits that they're purchasing when they buy a health benefit plan.
Representative Kanemer, do you have
a... Yeah, I do. Thank you, Mr. Chair. And sorry I missed the earlier part. I'm glad to hear this. You know, I guess that it's been interesting to me over this interim and in lots of other ones, actually. We keep coming back to this problem of discrimination against different practitioners. And I guess in my mind... there's an enormous problem here, because I think the legislature has been very explicit in both direction and in legislation about an inclusive approach. And our whole approach with the Affordable Care Act and any changes we're making in healthcare is predicated upon the notion that since we're going to have more people, we have to have more providers. And that means that we're going to have, and there aren't enough MDs to do everything. So we're going to have nurse practitioners, and we're going to have physician's assistants. But it also goes down the line to chiropractors, naturopaths, acupuncturists, physical therapists, psychologists, marriage and family, and professional counselors, and an enormous list. And I guess that what I see and what I feel needs some very serious intervention is that a lot of these people are being limited or not allowed onto panels, or have substantial impediments to reimbursement, which is another form of denial. And I think without this, our whole approach to changing healthcare in Oregon fails, because we will not have the people to service these people. And frankly, I don't know. You know, different services are interesting. I'm sorry to go on so long, but let me share a personal experience. About 12, 14 years ago, I was having trouble holding pop cans with my, not beer cans, pop cans, I'm sure it was, with my left hand.
It's worse.
Yes. And especially those diet ones, because they're terrible for you. But nonetheless, I went to my physician, who referred me to a surgeon and also to a neurologist, and they all came back and they said, you have arthritis, and surgery probably will not do you any good, and we can give you some pain medicine from time to time, but you need to learn to live with this. And it was interesting. I was at a Oregon City Chamber of Commerce meeting, and I'm whining to one of the participants there, and a naturopath who was there, who was also an acupuncturist, says to me, I can fix that. And frankly, I was not a believer. And, you know, after 10 treatments, I've not had further treatment. I have a tiny residual bit of pain, but almost none. I've been using this for those 14 intervening years. Okay, I think those are the experiences that people have with lots of different providers. And frankly, we're cheating and not realizing that evidently people's needs can be met in a plethora of ways. And I think in some ways I'm preaching to the choir, but I also think we need to have some serious discussions about whether we really mean non-discrimination in Oregon. And if we're going to have a system that is going to care for as many people as we think we're going to care for, we have to have a huge variety of practitioners, not just to provide a variety of services, but to provide adequate service.
This is an ongoing issue. We're obviously going to keep at it.
Yeah.
And there is a difference between the definition of scope of practice and the aspirations of some professionals about how they use their scope of practice.
Well, and I think that's, yeah, but we also license them within scopes of practice, and a lot of them have substantial training, and also, frankly, it doesn't take sometimes enormous expertise to do certain parts of those procedures.
Yeah, fortunately, disease is self-limiting in many instances. We're going to want to hear from you as you develop those. I hope, again, you can be back in February. We have the last 2 weeks of the session. Usually we've done our work and we have time to be exploring at our leisure. So I would hope we'll see you back on this topic. I know there's a lot of interest in people.
Chair Greenlick, I'd be happy to do that. And we'd also be happy to share where we're going with network adequacy as it evolves. Thank
Please.
You very much.
Thank you very much. I'll close this session. I'm going to open a special information session and ask Dr. Waller, Dr. Thornburg, who I see back there. We have this session, and then we have we've invited three of our members or their staffs to take a couple minutes each talking about bills that may show up with us in February. So I think we'll have a little bit more than the 20 minutes you're on the schedule for. We welcome you.
Can I just say something?
Please.
Thank you, Chair, for allowing me to invite this distinguished panel. And we spend so much of our time in this healthcare committee talking about healthcare delivery, and we know that something like 20% of health outcomes comes from the health delivery system. And the other 80% is environmental factors, genetics, behavior changes, things like that. And even, you know, we used to have pretty set percentages for each of those, but we're finding that the lines are blurring because environmental factors often turn on and off genes. So this whole field of epigenetics that you're getting into and how critical this is at the first 1,000 days, I'm very excited by. I want to say a couple things. I see some people in the audience, and I want to address some of their issues that are related to what you're doing afterwards. So I'd love a closing statement as well. But I'm really excited because...
You do remind me the most important healthcare decision we ever make is the choice of our parents.
Maybe not.
Okay, let's hear it.
Hi, my name is Lawrence Wallach, and I'm currently a Distinguished Fellow at the Moore Institute for Nutrition and Wellness at Oregon Health and Science University. I've been involved in public health work for 40 years. I'm running to catch up with Representative Greenlick on that. I don't get any closer, but I've got 40 years. And for the past 9 years, I served as Dean of the College of Urban and Public Affairs at Portland State University. And I really appreciate and thank you for the opportunity to talk with you today. At the core of public health is a wonderful upstream-downstream metaphor that reminds us that we are so often so busy pulling drowning people out of the river downstream that we don't have time to go upstream and to see what's causing people to fall in, do something about it as well. The mission of public health is prevention, and that means making a difference upstream. A few years ago, I heard my now friend and colleague, Dr. Ken Thornburg, talk about the new science of developmental origins of health and disease. And this redefined for me the meaning of upstream. Recent advances in biological and social sciences have provided important new findings on key factors in the very early development of chronic diseases, such as obesity, heart disease, and diabetes. And Dr. Thornburg is at the leading edge of the biological research. Further, this research indicates that some of the same factors that increase risk for these diseases are also strongly implicated in a range of problems related to cognitive development, educational performance, and mental health. What is significant and urgent is that the risk of these problems in children and adults is established much earlier than we previously understood. We now know that the most critical developmental period is during the first 1,000 days after conception, from conception to about age 2. The two main risk factors are biological changes related to the nutritional flow from the mother to the fetus and the level of continuous external stress on the mother, the type of intense stress brought on by conditions such as racism, inadequate housing, unemployment, and lack of options and opportunity. This is known as toxic stress. While the mother is obviously the environment of the developing fetus, the community is the environment of the mother. And here is where one's zip code, and maybe not just their parents, sadly becomes evident as a significant determinant of health. Recent Robert Wood Johnson Foundation National Commission on Healthy Americans concluded that our zip code is more important than our genetic code in determining our health. The implications of these findings are remarkable. Our zip code is more important than our genetic code in determining our health. For example, nutrition and stress factors are mediated through our community environment, in effect, our zip code. And these conditions can be improved through changes in public policy and innovative public health programming. So what does this mean? Oregon's healthcare reform activities that are placing a large bet on prevention, and they also need to incorporate the science of developmental origins of health and disease into planning at all stages. A great deal of work is focused on early childhood education and various prevention programs. This is extremely important, but now we know that we need to go back further into the earliest of the first 1,000 days, particularly for lower income populations, to justly, effectively, and efficiently address the problems that burden our healthcare systems and limit educational, economic, and social opportunities for individuals and communities. As a first step, we need to link efforts in prevention, early childhood education, housing, maternal and child health, economic development in related areas. We have to think bigger, bolder, and more comprehensively. And we can start doing this by applying this exciting new science that we'll hear more about in a minute. We can begin to demolish the silo structures by creating a common understanding of the cross-cutting factors that put some children at higher risk for a lifetime of social and health problems. So what are some suggestions for moving ahead? Here's three things to consider. First, establish a statewide first 1,000 days collaborative to do three things. Number one, make this science more accessible to policymakers and those who are working on the front lines of prevention. Two, to emphasize the urgency of both the nutritional and social or toxic stress that adversely impacts growth and development during the first 1,000 days. And three, recommend specific ways to integrate the science into the ongoing and new programs and policies that we have in Oregon. The second thing is to encourage a DOHOD in all policies movement. DOHOD is Developmental Origins of Health and Disease. This recognizes that health is interconnected with all other sectors such as business, agriculture, housing, transportation, and asks policymakers to consider what impact non-explicit health-related policies might have on the first 1,000 days in the health of our next generation. And the third thing would be to request existing statewide commissions, committees, boards, and panels already in place to incorporate the science of developmental origins of health and disease into their ongoing work. There is no more powerful space in our society than where our best science, our most compassionate values, and our best instincts as a community come together. This is one of those places. The urgency of the first 1,000 days is so important that we need to attend to this in order to make the kind of difference that we need to make to improve the health of Oregonians. We can make a difference, but we need the vision to see that space, to focus in order to map it out clearly, and then the political will to use it as a starting point to embark on the journey where we could really think about long-term sustained improved health for generation and generation to come. Thank you very much for this opportunity to talk with you.
Well, instantly, you really convinced me that choice is an important one. The parents not only have the good genetic code, I think they have to live in the right zip code.
Exactly. Chair Greenlake and members, thank you for allowing me to be here today. I'm Kent Thornburg, and I'm a professor of medicine at OHSU in cardiovascular medicine and the director of the Moore Institute for Nutrition and Wellness. I'm here because 25 years ago, a very important discovery was made by one of our colleagues, David Barker. And what he showed was your risk for having cardiovascular disease was very tightly related to how much you weighed when you were born. And what that meant is that if you were a 5-pound baby, you had a 3 to 5 times higher chance of dying of heart disease than if you were a 9-pound baby. He also showed that that curve goes upward again at the high-end scale, so that babies that are born at very high weights have the same risk as that are babies that are born at the very low end of the spectrum. And what this means is that babies that are born small and who are inadequately grown before they're born are already set on a track for having chronic diseases in their lifetime that makes them vulnerable for these diseases and a very high likelihood that they will attain them. People, babies that are born at the real high end of the scale are born that way in some, to some degree because their mothers have poor glucose control, and those mothers now are increasing in numbers because many more mothers are diabetic, and those diabetic mothers have babies that put on a lot of fat, and they have the same risk for that reason as the babies who are born at the low end of the scale. Now, we've learned a lot in the 25 years since that has happened, and by the way, those data have been repeated in 7 countries. Every country, including underdeveloped countries, show exactly the same thing. This is a very carefully controlled biological fact that human beings that are born at the low end of the scale and the very high end of the scale are at high risk for having disease. So what we've learned in 25 years, I can just give you 2 or 3 ideas so that you'll catch on to why this is so important. One is that embryos, before they even implant in their mother's womb, are already sensing the mother's nutritional level and setting the trajectory that they're going to grow. And that means that a mother's body, her composition, her nutrition from adolescence onward, is determining whether her baby is going to be large or small. It's not very much dependent on the genetic background of a person, except for a few people who have genetic diseases we know about. It's much more driven by the nutritional environment that the embryo and the fetus experiences that determines whether or not that fetus will grow in a healthy way and whether or not that baby that's born has a high risk of having disease later in its life. So we now know that almost all chronic diseases, and I can't give you any exceptions so far, but I'm saying that most ones, all the ones we've looked at, are regulated and are dependent on the way we grew early in our lives. So if we want to reduce the risks that people have for chronic diseases in our state, That means that we have to take care of mothers before their babies are born and during their pregnancy, or that vulnerability will not be reversed, and we will constantly be at the other end of this, trying to help people who already are at high risk or actually have chronic diseases, and we're going to be spending a lot of money on those people that could be prevented. So lastly, let me say the things that we now know are biologically responsible for this. One is that there are toxins in the environment which affect what we call epigenetics. These are not the gene code you got from your parents. These are genes that have been modified by the environment in which you grew. So, and there are certain toxins in the environment that can modify those. Phthalates and bisphenol A, for example. Those are well established. Secondly, and the most powerful effect, is nutrition. The nutrition that the mother eats during her pregnancy and the ones that she came into her pregnancy with are very powerful drivers of the way a baby grows, both before she's even pregnant, when the embryo is first fertilized, and during her pregnancy. Low oxygen, babies that live on low oxygen because they didn't make good placentas, again, is another nutrition issue, and that's another reason. And lastly, just as important as nutrition is maternal stress. Mothers who have high cortisol levels have that cortisol, goes across the placenta, it affects the way the baby grows, and the baby is born smaller. And those smaller babies have now rewired their genes, if I can use that term, so that they're at risk for the rest of their life for having these chronic diseases. And let me say what those are. Type 2 diabetes, heart disease, and what we now call metabolic disease, obesity. Those are driven almost exclusively by the environment before a person is born, and then the external environment has opportunities in many cases to drive it even further. So lastly, let me say, I think we can break this cycle, and I think that if we are able to have policies in this state that help generate women who are healthy, young girls who go into their pregnancy in a healthy way, that are good diets during their pregnancy and the first 1,000 days. And the reason we call it the first 1,000 days is all of the organs in the body are complete by birth except the brain. The brain needs another 2 years to get the right head start for cognitive development and behavior. So we call 1,000 days for the development of all the organs in the body, and those are required to allow a healthy body for the rest of the life of that individual. Thank you.
You want to start?
Because I know Representative Kenny Geyer is going to go on for hours, probably. So she said she had to close.
No, she won't. I'll keep her.
Okay. You're saying the first 1,000 days of the baby's life are the most important?
The first day, we start counting on the day that the egg is fertilized.
So?
Yeah.
So from conception
up through 2 years of life.
At that point, then that's the most important part, to get the right nutrition for the baby at that stage.
That's correct.
Hey, Ken, let me ask you a question again. We're continuing to look for the cause of the metabolic disease epidemic we're facing in children. What is there in the first part of that first 1,000 years has changed so dramatically, say, from a decade ago or from 20 years ago to now,
okay,
that ends up with so many more obese children than we had 20 years ago, higher proportion of obese
children? Right. We think we know the answer to that question, and we think it's because we've had 3 generations now in Oregon, across the United States, where people have eaten poor diets. They've depended on industry to give them their food, and people don't eat whole foods anymore. They're absolutely required to build a healthy body.
But they didn't 20 years ago either.
No, but it takes 2 or 3 generations to make this happen. So let me give you an example. The egg that made me, I'm in my 60s now, was made 100 years ago in the ovary of my mother when she was in her mother's womb. My grandmother nourished the egg that made me and made the epigenetic changes that make me at risk for having disease now. So if you can't look at this across a three-generation time frame, you can't understand why things happen all of a sudden. They appear to happen suddenly, but they've actually been happening over three generations.
So it's 3,000 years we're worried about, not 1,000.
Yeah, that's right.
Well, David Barker used to talk about 100 years of nutritional flow into the first 1,000 days. So it does go back several generations. The other thing is that the food environment has substantially changed. And so you've got an environment now that is less conducive than ever to people who want to make the right choices about food and who are more susceptible to the consequences of adverse nutrition.
I think
processed food,
yes.
The whole grains, vegetables.
That's correct.
Fruits.
I think we got a lot of drugs because I've kind of ran by the motto, a Lipitor a day keeps the bacon from going away, and I'm hearing that's not the right motto to use.
Well, we might not be wrong, but the truth is that unless people are able to have good nutrition, they can't build bodies that will be healthy.
I mean, the bottom line on this, and the thing that got me so excited about
it, I thought it was just to renumber the zip codes.
Well, that's change the test scores.
Yeah.
But what this really does, what it does is indicate that even the best public health programs that we may have are targeted too late and won't be sufficient to overcome the disadvantage, the increased risk that people bring into this world at the very earliest possible times. And, for example, one of the state goals is early childhood education, and the indicator is readiness for kindergarten. That's the thing you want to change. Well, if you want to change readiness for kindergarten scores, what you have to do is you have to go back into the first 1,000 days, not just go back into the first 2 years. So this kind of research, the main effect that this could have is to shift the way that people think about what constitutes upstream and what you need to do very, very early to reduce the need for programs later on or to make those programs more effective by reducing the severity of what people bring to those programs.
I think one thing, I mean, I know Representative Kenny Geyer and I've kind of had comments or this discussion on the side, and I think we both agree on it. She'll tell me if I'm wrong, but I mean, we have WIC, where we say this is what a mother's going to get to help with the nutrition, and I think that's something we need to look at, not only there, but in our SNAP program as well, where we say, no, we're government, we're not going to aid you in becoming a type 2 diabetic. We're going to help you remove yourself, so you can't go into a store and just buy chips and things like this, and I think it's something we seriously need to look at the legislative level. I know there's some restrictions with the federal government, but it's stuff we need to start asking for waivers for, and it's just like a WIC coupon. These are the foods you can go buy if you're getting supplemental nutrition from the state government.
So I've seen some of your slide presentations that talk about the intergenerational and compare, you know, twins and things like that and what happens over time and the actually organ development, what happens in the ability to process insulin and things like that when the environment's not right at whatever, the 34th week.
That's correct.
So this information is really great, and I think one of the things that I feel is that we need to be doing everything we can to not just think about how to treat things, but how to prevent and create an environment where people can have the healthiest. And it's obviously hardest for low-income people to have that kind of environment. And it's nutrition, it's the stress. I thank you for pointing that out because that's huge. There are environmental factors, toxics, you know, chemicals have been shown to have impact. And the earlier that exposure is, the greater it is. So that's a huge concern. There's increasing body of research around electromagnetic frequency, Wi-Fi. I see people who are in this audience who are really concerned about that we've not had a lot of research dollars for, but we have a kind of constant bombardment of toxins on fetuses and young children, and so I'm very concerned about that just in terms of overall maternal and child health. And I do think that it's an obligation that we continue to look at how can we improve the environment, how can we get people greater access to those kind of healthy foods. So some of the things that we've passed
recently are like the Farm Direct program that allows those WIC recipients to receive vouchers to spend at farmers markets. So you're supporting a local food economy and bringing food into neighborhoods where people may not have had purchasing power before but now do. So bringing food into low-income neighborhoods or addressing the food desert situation. Just a variety of things like that where I think we, you know, one of the reasons I'm excited to have you here is because I think we really need to think about every strategy that we can that affects the environment and gives people access to having healthy decisions.
Mary, you think about social policy a lot. What would you say we could do as at the legislative level? I mean, we can understand the problem better and all that, but what can we actually do in legislation to change things, to affect things?
You've been in this even longer than me and thought about all these issues more than I have, but one thing that you and I both know is that risk is embedded in the way we organize our society, and we do that through the collective decisions we made reflected in public policy. So if every policy, and this is what the DOHOT or some people talk about health in all policies approach is, to think about whatever the policy is, what are the implications from an upstream perspective about what we're doing to reinforce existing inequalities or reduce inequalities that we know lead to the social inequalities that we know lead to health inequalities. So if we could just start to change that consciousness that health is really embedded in everything we do. It's not just part of the healthcare sector. It's just not something that has the word health in it. But it's in agriculture. Transportation may be one of the most significant issues because transportation is mobility to take advantage of education, employment, training. And we know that those things all have a major impact on the collective public health. So if we could just say the first value is the health value, is what we're doing helping that or inhibiting that? That would be a major start, because I don't think there is one significant policy that you would do that could change it.
That's not necessarily very helpful from a practical perspective. I mean, I agree with you that theoretically, but we have a committee on transportation, we have a committee on business and labor, we have a committee on the environment.
Okay.
I mean, I can't go to them and say, hey, everything you guys are doing, I want you to think about health, and here's how you can do it. The question is there something as a health committee we can do? I mean, is there specific legislation that can help?
Well, one thing is the notion of establishing a significant first 1,000 days collaborative up and down at the state that could carry this work out. But I would remind you that the U.S. Housing and Urban Development, the U.S. Department of Transportation, and the U.S. Department of Agriculture recently all worked together on a Healthy Communities Initiative that cut across the traditional boundaries, where they stopped saying, well, we can't go over these boundaries, to saying, why can't we go over these boundaries, and why can't we jointly take on legislation or take on funding issues? So one possibility would be, wouldn't it be innovative for Oregon, and Oregon is the place of innovation, if you had a special subcommittee that brought together members from these different communities with the idea of, is there a different way we could go about the policy development process that would put health as at least one of the top three questions we always asked in evaluating the policy?
Yeah, that's it.
I have another comment. I have another comment to make, and that is that even though many people say to me that they think that WIC takes care of all the needs of pregnant women, it really doesn't. And this needs to be looked at it again. And I think that we might be missing the boat by believing that pregnant women out there, especially ones who don't have means, are being well cared for and can eat well, because they generally can't. And we should find ways that we can legislate policy that will bring their diets up to par with people who have means. And that's something we could do in a very powerful way.
Well, I'll just say as an example that we had a bill that many people signed on. I think something like 75% of the legislature signed on to the WIC Farm Direct bill last year.
Yeah, that's true.
And we were asking for $500,000. We got $100,000. And I think part of why I was hoping you'd come here, and I'd love for you to go to other committees, is because there's not enough of a recognition of how at the heart these first 1,000 days are. So we, it's in our all of our allocation decisions. We let sunset the food crop, the farm crop tax credit last year, which is where we give a tax credit to farmers who are giving the produce from the land in Oregon back to food banks and things like that. And that was sunsetted, and we're hoping to reverse that this year. But I think we need to recognize that we are going to be paying for it on the back end on dealing with chronic diseases if we don't support these kind of policies that allow fresh fruits and vegetables and grains and other kinds of things get into low-income hands.
And into our schools.
Into our schools, yeah. Into, you know, particularly maternal health and young children, but of course into our schools as well. So we do have a few bills on that, but I think the bigger picture is really important to understand. This has to be a priority.
I want to just reinforce something you said that links nutrition with increased food availability and economic development. Mm. And this is something that we're looking at doing in parts of the Portland metropolitan region. The economic development can't be separated from the nutritional development. Mm-hmm. And because we know stress plays such a major role, and financial instability is such an important aspect of chronic toxic stress, that to the extent that we could link economic development, social entrepreneurship, and the things we know to be healthy, like expanding food systems, this could just be a comprehensive approach that really does cut across different sectors and bring benefits to all segments of the community, not just those that might be at a particular disadvantage.
I think, I mean, with what we're talking about here, there's been a lot of societal changes. I mean, I'm not quite 60 yet, but I went through before cell phones were ever around and things like that, and you just went home and dinner was at this time. You sat down together and you ate and things like that, and now we've come to a society of more convenience and what can I get really fast. I think it's one of the things like we could look at as a healthcare committee of recognizing, okay, right at conception, we look at that child right then, and we're going to expand our WIC program and give basically a dietitian, these are the items that you can buy and how you should be fixing meals to nurture that child and take care of it at that point. And I think that's something we could look at to add with what we did with the WIC last
time. We also need patience, don't we, though? I mean, we're dealing with things that this mom's outcome is going to be two generations away. I mean, there'll be some proximate, but
there will.
But the distal outcomes will be the most important.
I think the reversal of the trend we've seen, you've said in the last decade, I say in the last three decades, we will see that reverse if we could reverse the way we eat and the way we live in our neighborhoods.
I'm going to thank you both so much for coming. I mean, this should have been a three-hour session, and maybe we can figure out how to do that in a broader session to invite folks that won't be in the context of a committee, but there's obviously a lot. This is the second epigenetics discussion we've had over the past three sessions or so, but I think we need to take it more seriously.
Mr. Chair, and it should have been first so there were more people to hear it.
Yeah, that's the problem. I mean, I was really saying it's exactly right. I was hoping there'll be other people watching the stream. So
thank you all for having us.
Yeah, we really appreciate you guys coming.
Yep, thank you.
I'll close this work session. We have invited, as I said, three of our colleagues by their staff to come and talk to us about bills that might come before us in February. I see Representative Jensen in the back. Will you come up here and introduce your concept to us? We have, we have Tomei staff, is that right?
Yes.
I can do that one, and who else?
Doug Barber for Representative Harker's.
Okay. Doug, will you join us? You have the honors, Representative.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you for the opportunity to introduce this topic for you. And it currently appears in LC 185, which authorizes the Board of Medical Imaging to waive specific licensing requirements for technicians in rural areas. As of January 1, 2014, Every imaging modality now requires a license in the state of Oregon. Ultrasound, MRI, nuclear medicine, and CT. These licenses are in addition to a technologist's primary X-ray license. In order to apply for a state's license, a technologist must hold a credential issued by a credentialing organization in a medical imaging modality recognized by the board. This is the highest standard of licensure amongst any of the border states, or for that matter, any state in the nation. Meeting the minimum standards to sit a national exam has proven itself to be a challenge for technologists in rural hospital settings. For example, the Nuclear Medical Technology Certification Board has a track that the minimum requirement of 4 years/8,000 hours of clinical experience within the modality of nuclear medicine. In some circumstances, rural hospitals do not have the necessary patient volume to sustain or garner the required hours of experience within a state's time frame. This is true for the Grand Ronde Hospital in La Grande and their nuclear medicine technologist. Without this statute change, the patients in La Grande and neighboring communities will lose access to nuclear medicine and would result in patients having to travel out of state to Boise or the Tri-Cities as the nearest locations. Either that or perhaps then going on to St. Charles and Bend. This bill will help the Grand Ronde and other rural hospitals to continue providing access to medically necessary services to their patients and the communities they serve. I believe this is a very worthwhile bill, and I will urge you when we drop the bill for you to consider it and move it on through the process.
I spoke to the board chair about this bill, who has no problem with it, and I'm sure we'll be able to move this very quickly.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you very much, sir. Who's next?
Go for it. Chair Greenlick, members of the committee, Doug Barber here today, pinch hitting for Representative Harker, who could not be here, to introduce LC 90, which deals with self-insurance for health care for businesses with 51 to 100 employees.
If he went off to Australia, we don't have to put up with his business.
That's true. So you remember last session you passed House Bill 2240, which was the ACA alignment bill. In that bill, it changes the definition of small group. Currently, Oregon defines small group as two groups of 2 to 50. Under the ACA, that will change to groups of 2 to 100 on January 1st, 2016. This bill doesn't directly impact that definitional change, but elsewhere in Oregon law, there is a prohibition on reinsurance for small groups. So as the definition of small group expands, this prohibition also expands. And reinsurance is the stop-loss coverage that businesses buy to protect themselves from catastrophic claims when they self-insure. I talked with the insurance division about the prohibition. They say it dates back to 1967 when we defined small group as 2 to 25, and they weren't certain about the rationale for it, but they think it was to protect businesses that were not sophisticated enough to take on the responsibility of self-insurance. Certainly, that sophistication is not an issue for businesses in the 51 to 100 group. I've met with a number of businesses around the state that are currently self-insured, and very successfully. This committee has talked a lot about individual responsibility in terms of their health care. As I talked to these employers, this is one this is really employer engagement. The ones who self-insure really take to heart, I think, the need and desire to have a healthier workforce. and they work very closely with their employees to do that. And they can tweak their self-insured plan to make that happen. What this bill will do was simply, it's a status quo bill. It would allow businesses above that have more than 51 covered lives to continue to self-insure if that's what they want to do.
Okay.
And it's a tiny piece of the market, but it's a very important piece for those that are self-insured.
If it comes to us, and I suspect it will, although it might conceivably go to Business and Labor, I don't think you'll have a lot of trouble with this one. Thank you for introducing.
I'll just say it's very exciting because he took me to AMCO, which is self-insured business in my own district, and what you were saying about how invested they are in their own employees' health because they're self-insuring them, and the kinds of great policies they've had long before ACA came and said you have to, you know, insure at this level. They've exceeded that for a long time and saved a lot of money. So I'm very enthusiastic, and I hope our committee gets it.
All right. Thank you very much, Doug.
Chair Greenlake, members of the committee, my name is Jake Foster. I'm a legislative assistant for Representative Tomei, and Representative Tomei was unable to be here today, so she asked me to tell you a little bit about LC 118, which will likely be coming before your committee in February. The American Cancer Society brought to our attention a problem relating to preventative colonoscopy screenings. There's some ambiguity currently about whether polyp removal during a preventative colonoscopy screening is subject to copays. Some doctors are coding it as a diagnostic service, others as preventative. Under the Affordable Care Act, preventative screening for colorectal cancer is required coverage for adults beginning at age 50 and not subject to copays. Federal guidelines explain that the removal of polyps during a colonoscopy is an integral part of the procedure and therefore not subject to cost sharing. But still some confusion over billing exists. LC 118 will clarify that...
Hey, can I add to that?
Sure.
My understanding of it is it's not... only, or not necessarily, the problem of the removal of the polyp. The problem comes with the charge for the lab, for the pathology services for the polyp itself.
Chair Greenlake, yes, I think that's true.
Which is even crazier. So, I mean, I think this is something we're gonna definitely want to look at.
LC 118 will clarify that polyp removal during a preventative colonoscopy is considered preventative and therefore not subject to copays and cost sharing. If you have further questions, you can contact...
And that the lab results from that removal is also covered. It has that in the LC as well.
That's right. Yes. Jason Parks from the American Cancer Society can answer further questions, and also Amy Goodall, who I believe is in the back of the room.
We'll do that when we hear the bill.
Sure.
I'm sure it will come to us, and I don't think we'll have a big problem with it. Hey, I just do need to ask you, and I told the Cancer Society as well, it'd be very useful if it's between now and then you have the insurance companies involved so that when you come in we'll know if there's a problem or if there's not a problem. Be better if it's not a problem.
Really?
Okay. Thank you very much for coming.
Thank you,
Doug. Thank you very
much.
Thank you guys for hanging in for the residual.
Sorry, I got called out a couple of times.
The hard-headed half.
Jim and I are the hardcore.
Close the session. And anything to do, Madam Administrator?
Unless you want to talk about February for like 2 seconds.
Two seconds.
Okay. I was just going to say we meet Wednesday, Friday.
At 1.
From 1 to
2:45.
Look
forward to seeing you then.
Wow. We're adjourned.
Wow. Is that true?
Indigestion.
Sandy? Yeah.
Wow.
Is that true?
Indigestion.
Sandy?
Yeah.